originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. An intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who took Derby 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pradnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano. A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm your host, retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I am joining you tonight from our Jimmy John's of Lexington, Kentucky studio. I would like to thank all of you listening tonight on Sirius 219 XM 206, and also to those of you listening to our website at www.horseracingradio.net. As you all know, a portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides financial assistance to riders who have suffered devastating on-track injuries. I was one of the fortunate ones. I was able to walk away from the sport, but not all were so lucky. So if you are able to help, I encourage you to visit their website at www.pdjf.org. So our guest tonight has won leading rider titles at the Meadowlands and Aqueduct. He was the first rider to win 1,000 races at the Meadowlands, and he remains the all-time leading rider there. He's won 16 graded stakes victories, 4,144 wins total, and over $74 million in earnings. It is a pleasure to introduce jockey Nick Santagata. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Christine. A pleasure to be here.
Nick, can't wait to hear your story. Now, I can tell from the accent, you're from Brooklyn, yeah?
Yes, I was born in Brooklyn, and I moved to Staten Island 1 year of my life, and then I moved out to, I met my wife, Lori, my lovely wife, and we have one daughter, Nicole, and we moved out to Long Island. So, yes, it is a Brooklyn accent from The Sopranos.
I love it, Nick. How did you get introduced to horse racing?
Well, my father, he had a boss that owned horses, and he always pushed me to try to be a jockey, but I really wanted to be a professional bowler. I had to own a friend of mine who was my best friend. His name is Scott Zimmerman, and we go bowling all the time. And then when I was in the bowling alley, somebody says, you should take up your father's advice, and a couple of guys, and I went out to Jamaica Bay Riding Academy out in Brooklyn, and I just kind of worked my way up the ladder from the hot walker to exercise boy and to jockey. And it was probably the best run of my life.
So you were a professional bowler, you say?
Well, when I was in high school, I was averaging 190. That was 1975. And my plan was to go on tour. I would be in a bowling alley all my days, being a mechanic, practicing. And I just chose a jockey life and when I graduated high school. And ever since 1975, I'm still working, getting on horses and selling horses in the jockey's room on the Naira circuit. And I enjoy it. I love it. It's a little rough right now because we had some bad winters, but it's the next best thing to riding races, galloping horses.
I got to tell you, Nick, I actually went bowling last night. And
What's your average?
It's not good. I really don't want to say on air. I'm embarrassed. I need to take lessons
That's
from you. I'm terrible. But I admire you for having an average of 190. That's pretty impressive. But so were you in high school, were you always naturally athletic?
Well, you know, like every boy from Brooklyn, you know, me personally, I like to be a baseball player. And obviously, you know, my body didn't compare to my dreams. So I tried to become a bowler. My father loved bowling, and everybody loved bowling. And then everybody, why don't you be a jockey? You know, everybody be a jockey. And I went out to Aqueduct. I had gotten a hot walking job, and I spent all my money from hot walking and exercising, learning how to exercise ponies. Then we went out to Jamaica Bay Riding Academy. And then we just eventually, you know, my dad, we weren't fortunate enough to have, riding schools like they have today. Chris McCarron Riding School, which they had. And, you know, you can see a lot of the riders today, they come from the Puerto Rican jockey school. And it's when they come into, you know, to ride races, they're so far advanced. People like me, Migliori, Mike Venezia, for us it was kind of learn and go. They weren't really riding schools for us to learn at. So, you know, we had to learn and go and just kind of pick our way through.
Well, you mentioned the Jamaica Bay Riding Academy. What was that exactly? Was that just to teach you how to ride basically just horses in general?
I would go there, and they had a thing called jockey lessons. You know, the guy would teach. We would run up and down the shore of the Belt Parkway. They got the little the Jamaica Bay there, and we would try to get the seat. You know, just the basics, how to learn how to be a rider and stuff. And I got fortunate enough to go to Aqueduct, and I was working for somebody that put me in a job learning how to work from the bottom up, being a stable hand and being a hot walker, and then eventually getting on horses. And then eventually, you know, I got advanced and I became a jockey. But, you know, the little Jamaica Bay Riding Academy kind of just set the basis, get your seat and everything and just get a feel. They were only ponies, but, you know, in this game, you got to go step by step. You just can't start on thoroughbreds, you know.
This is true, definitely. And, Nick, how old were you when you arrived to the racetrack?
Well, actually, I probably was a late bloomer compared to racetrack people. I wasn't born into the game. You know, I was born into Brooklyn. I was born on cement. I wasn't fortunate enough to be born on Kentucky bluegrass. And I didn't start riding until I was 20.
Wow.
I mean, some of my best buddies, Wesley Ward and Cash Asmussen, Steve Asmussen, Steve Court, they were born into the game. And so, you know, they too, when they came into the game, they were almost like old riders, and they were apprentices.
Yes, you really had nobody in your family to help guide you along either then. So it was pretty much
nobody in my family. My father was a factory worker. My mother was a stay-at-home mom. And we lived in Brooklyn. And, you know, we started from the bottom up. I mean, there's times we were on electric payments, and we couldn't make food bills, you know, sort of like everybody, you know, in that day. And I was, God bless me with, you know, a little athletic ability. And, you know, fortunate enough, I could, you know, from bowling and from being, from a little baseball, that I could become a jockey. I had the right body for it. So, you know, and it's just an exciting sport, and I just fell in love with it.
How big are you, Nick? Did you ever struggle with your weight?
My weight, I kept my weight in check. I did everything naturally. I would diet. I would go in the hot box, you know, but never to the severe point of, you know, bulimic or diet pills or, you know, having to starve myself. So the way some people, you know, fight their weight, my weight was pretty good. My weight was pretty good.
How tall are you?
Excuse me?
How tall are you?
I was 5'2". So the biggest I ever got into my life, when I first started riding, I was about 126. But I got my weight down to about, you know, apprentice weight and everything. And I generally kept my weight at about 110, 111. You know, I was about basic then. And then a little, as I got older and older, you know, I would do a pound or two over. I mean, the weights kind of got, as I got more into the game, they kind of raised the weights a little. So it kind of made it a little easier for everybody.
I was going to say, early on, you know, back in the day, weights were even lighter. So you had to be even smaller starting out.
When I first started, I had the 10-pound apprentice. and the weights would get down to 104, 103. And, you know, you run, in those days, when I was riding, I signed a contract, and I was riding for my contract holder. And, you know, you had to do the weight, otherwise you wouldn't ride the horse. And you're working all day, and you're planning your future just on him, you know. So that's, yeah, in those, you're right, because in those days, 70s, late early 80s, those, the weights were very low. So there were some horses were getting with 99s, 100s, and if you did too far over, maybe 5 pounds over, you couldn't ride the horse. They would take you off.
Mm. Yeah, that's light. I never had to tack that light.
It's very light. You barely see that now. You know,
no.
A lot of times when guys start now, sometimes they even wave the 10-pound bug. They do a couple of pounds over.
But not back in the day. That's crazy. Now, you mentioned the contract, and that's something we don't see anymore. Now you just have an agent, and you go out, and you hustle, and you ride for, you know, pretty much everyone. But tell us how you met the trainer and how you established that contract.
Well, you know, when you first come on the track, and you're not very smart, so you just kind of, you know, you want to be some, you want to just, you know, you take somebody's word for it and everything. And I mean, I was working for the gentleman for 2 years, and he said, well, I'm not going to ride if you don't have a contract. And, you know, what am I going to do? I signed a contract with the gentleman. I was making only like $90 a week, and the first five horses I rode, three of them went for him, and I didn't even get paid for them. He was the owner trainer. Mm. And thank God, you know, we have the Jockeys Guild, kind of like the Jockeys Union, which they established having certificates where you didn't have to have a contract. And you could be kind of like a free agent. You can be an apprentice and a free agent and you know, just pick and choose where you go. Because with a contract, you're obligated to probably be in your contract holder's barn all day. You had to ride all his horses if there was somebody else in the race. And whatever he said, go. It was like almost having a contract with a team, like way back in the 60s and the 50s with a baseball, you know, a football team. There wasn't a free agent. But thank God we've had the Jockeys Guild, and they kind of, you know, paved the way for jockeys, like apprentices like that, to be free agents.
Yeah, so it's a much better system, in your opinion, today then.
Oh, if it wasn't for the Jockeys Guild, the first thing the Jockeys Guild did, they would make the jockeys get paid out of the office. They would get their 10% automatically from the bookkeeper. In days back, you know, before Eddie Arcaro, Johnny Long, the Willie Shoemaker, after a race, you would have to go to the trainer and get your money. And that's why jockeys would hire an agent. They would have the agent go to the trainer, you know, try to collect the money for them, and in turn would give the agent 25%. So now the Jockeys Guild, they're established where after the race, they take their 10% fee from the winning fee for the jockeys, and it automatically goes into the jockeys' account, which is it's like when the computer was invented. That's how far advanced it got the jockeys.
Yeah, that's made a huge difference, I'm sure. And so, Nick, how long were you in this contract for?
Well, I was in a contract. If memory serves me right, I think it was a 3-year contract, but I'd gotten out after 1 year, less than a year. And what I had to do was, after I had to buy the contract back from my contract hold for $3,500. And at that time, that was a lot of money for me. And we kind of made it where it was $50 a month. And every time I would win a race, $50 would go into his account. And eventually I had to pay the $35. Because as soon as I left the barn, I took off. I got my own agent. And I could go to every barn and work horses for people instead of being in his barn all day. So eventually I wound up paying the money out from him that I owed him. And eventually I went on to win about 65 races with an apprentice, which isn't a lot. But being bogged down in a contract holder's barn, you know, that's pretty good. It worked out pretty good for me.
Jockey Nick Santagata joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Nick, as an apprentice, tell us some of the journeymen that were riding with you there in New York, and did you have anyone in the room who kind of took you under their wing and showed you the ropes?
Well, one of my best friends was Angel Cordero. And at that time, nobody was better than Angel. And he would help me out from time to time, tell me what to do and everything. But all you would have to do is, the people I rode against probably are all in the Hall of Fame. I had the half, I had the, one of the last part of my Bugs apprentices with Steve Corton. And then I rode against Cass Asmussen. I rode against Angel Cordero, Jose Santos, Chris Antley, Jorge Velasquez, Jacinto Vasquez, Gene Cougar, who should be in the Hall of Fame, Jerry Bailey, Richard Migliore, who probably should be in the Hall of Fame if he ever gets there, Javier Castellano. There's a lot of people that I did ride against during my time that were very good riders. That's on top, and then on top of the people with shipping would be Chris McCarron, Lafitte Pinkai, and it was a tough jockey colony then in New York in the 80s and early 90s. Mike Smith was there.
Yeah, that's a pretty good list you just rattled off there, Nick.
That's a pretty good old spot, yeah.
I'd say so. And early on, did you find that you struggled with anything particular? I mean, I remember when I rode, it took me a while to really get good at switching sticks, and then eventually I was even better left-handed.
Well,
but did you find that was the case?
Go ahead. I didn't really the most thing that's what is the struggle is to get live mounts, you know, and I mean, I probably did all the basics. I kind of caught on pretty quick, but it was always tough to get, you know, to get tough mounts when in that day and age, you know, because even like I would stay at Aqueduct in the winter, so this way when everybody went to Florida, it could open up a lot of doors. But then eventually everybody started staying for the winter, and it got tougher and tougher. So it was a fight in New York. It's a fight, and that's only Aqueduct. And then when you get to Belmont, it's harder. And then when you get to Saratoga, it's like an all-star. It's an all-star meetup, and it would be tougher and tougher each track as you went to.
So how long did you stay in New York?
Well, I would stay in New York. I stood in New York maybe a couple of years year-round, maybe 5 years. But I would, in the summertime, I stayed in New York until about March and then go to Monmouth, which is my favorite track of all time. We have the swimming pool. I would get the New York shippers, and I would have the people from the Meadowlands that would stable at Jersey. So it was better than riding over there with more opportunities than staying in Belmont and Saratoga riding against a tough colony. And Saratoga was only a 28-day meet then. So I would just go to Monmouth, and then eventually I went to Parks. It would open up a lot more doors than just staying stagnant, you know, if you weren't getting a lot of live mounts in one spot. That's one thing I could say. If I was a jockey today and I wasn't doing good in one spot, there's plenty of tracks where you can go to, you know, maybe you can do a little, you know, better on that track rather than, the money's not as good as New York or Santa Anita, but winning is everything. It picks your whole attitude up when you start winning.
You mentioned, yeah, the East Coast. That's where I rode, Nick, and just so many opportunities, so many different racetracks to travel to. And you mentioned the pool at Monmouth. They've closed that up. They filled it in, Nick. I'm very disappointed. Yeah. I hear lots of stories about that swimming pool back there. And
that swimming pool was Olympic-sized swimming pool that Mr. Islam put in when he first opened up Mama Park. It was like riding. When you're winning, so you're feeling good because you're winning. Then you have a pool. It's like a country club. The weather's good. And you're renting a place at the shore. And the weather's great, so it was one of the best times of my life. But yeah, they filled it in for the picnic tables outside for the Breeders' Cup that year. And lo and behold, when I don't know if it was a curse, but it was the worst rainstorm they had, I think, for 2 days, and nobody could stay out anywhere near the picnic area.
So much for that, right? So when you first arrived to Monmouth, did you find you had immediate success there, or how long did it take for you to get rolling at Monmouth?
Well, no. When I first went to Monmouth, it was a tough colony, too. because you had Jerry Bailey was there, you had Don Broomfield was there, Mickey Salomon was there, and everybody would just, they would follow their outfits from circuit to circuit. And then eventually, you know, Jerry Bailey would leave and Craig Perrett would leave and go to New York. So it kind of got a little bit, you know, easier as the years went by. But each year that I went there, I would ride the Meadowlands meet. I would build up a little bit more clientele. And, you know, in each year, I would win some more races. And eventually, I would Julie Crone would come there and Chris Antley would come there and Herb McCauley would come there before they went to New York. And, you know, you can only reach a certain amount. I can only get to the second leader rider there. I think Julie Crone beat me one year, but yeah, that was the best meet I think I had there.
Well, as I mentioned in the introduction, Nick, you still remain the all-time leading rider there at Monmouth at the Meadowlands, and that's turf racing, so you must have been a very good turf rider. And describe to our audience the difference riding a dirt race versus a turf race.
Well, a turf race and a dirt race, it's different surfaces, obviously. You're not getting much kickback dirt on the turf, so horses wouldn't like the dirt on their face on the dirt, so we'd run them on the turf. They would level out a lot more. But mostly grass races today are built inside the dirt course, so it's kind of a little sharp turn. You got to save a little bit of ground. And generally, on grass horses, I mean, unless you get someone, a horse that's loose with a nice, easy lead, mostly you're generating closes. You see, like, the last 16th of a mile, you can see maybe 10 horses, 5 horses all trying to close and get to win. And also on grass racing, you got to have a good trip. You know, you can't. Most of the horses are bunched up because it's a little smaller than the outside track. And you just got to try to get a good trip, you know, try to get some room to run at.
So then what makes a good turf rider?
Everybody always says that. I mean, my favorite turf riders are Jerry Bailey, Jose Santos, Angel Cordero. They would save ground, and they would have so, you know, you got to have a good horse where, you know, so when you do get a little spot, you can just punch on the gear of that punch on that horse, and he can just get in, accelerate in and out of that hole, and because it would take a while. If a horse would take too long to try to get through them holes, the hole would close. And grass race, it's so exciting, grass race, because you could be in the front until maybe 30 yards before the wire. Somebody that might have been waited a little bit longer for the hole to open up, and he comes flying. Everybody loves grass racing.
Would you say that you are more of a speed rider or more of a come-from-behind rider, or how would you describe your riding style?
I try to adopt for the bias of the race. Unless I had a horse that had to be absolutely last or absolutely on the lead. But if the track was playing for speed, I would try to lay closer to the pace and take it from there. And if the track was dead for speed, I would stay off the, you know, I would stay off the, I would stay off the pace. But I didn't try to have one specific style. I would just try to gear my day to how the track was playing that day. And some tracks wouldn't be playing that day, maybe for speed, and some would be playing, you know, for come from behind us. And that's how I would handicap my day.
So you were pretty observant of how the track was playing. What else would you do to prepare for a race? Would you watch replays? Would you maybe even talk to other riders? How would you go about that?
Well, I would. When I was riding back then, we didn't have the replay channel, you know, that they have in most jockeys own now. But I would buy the racing form. That was, you know, they now have the program, the big program. Sometimes they give it to you free in the jocks room. But I would have to buy a racing form. And that would be my knowledge for the day.
Now tell us about the atmosphere in the jocks room, because it's unique in that you're all competitors, but yet you all gather back to the same locker room, basically the jocks room. And does it get stressful in there? Did tensions get, you know, do fights break out? Have you ever been in a fight in the jocks room?
Well, you know, obviously, everybody that knows me, I probably was a hot, you know, it's, like you said, you know, even a race and somebody beat you, you know, it's just fine. You can accept it. But if someone, you know, generally every day is trying to bother you and, you know, and try to, you know, try to hurt you or you know, you can accept it once, maybe twice. But if it's day after day, you know, you have to put a stop to it, you know. And sometimes it does get heated up in the jock room, you know. And, you know, it's unfortunately we all have to come back into the same room. And generally most jockeys get along with each other. They're friends, you know, until the bell opens up. And no jockey likes to see any other jockey get hurt. Everybody has families to go home to. And we want to win races. Everybody wants to win races. And everybody come back safe. But, you know, sometimes, you know, things happen in a race. And, you know, and you come over, you apologize, I'm sorry. But sometimes when it happens day after day after day, then, you know, then sometimes you got to, you know, say, yo, enough's enough, you know?
I get it. But yeah, I've heard some stories about you, Nick. I just...
Oh, boy.
But along the same line, you mentioned safety obviously comes first. So when you see an apprentice come into the room, a younger rider who's not really sure of things, do you try to help coach those younger riders?
Well, most of the time, if we see an apprentice come into the room, we try to help him, you know, because he's going to ride with us, and we want him to learn. You know, obviously, you know, if he's got a good attitude, and you know, and he's willing to work with everybody, listen to all the older riders, listen to all the older riders' advice. You know, we'll help him at everything. You know, we understand apprentices; they make mistakes. You know, but you could work a million horses in the morning, but riding in a race, it's night and day. You know, there's so many things going on. And, you know, an apprentice has to learn. And if he's willing to learn and have a good attitude and, you know, listen to the old riders and, you know, everybody would help him. We'll just help him and accept him, you know.
Well, Nick, it is time for us to go to a quick commercial break. Folks, stay with us. You are listening to Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
This is Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm your host, Christina McManigal, and I am joined tonight by jockey Nick Santagata. Nick, now coming back from break, I would like to talk a little bit about, as I mentioned in the introduction, you've won 16 graded stakes victories. And what sticks out to you as your favorite?
Well, I guess I have to say, I only won one grade one stake. which was the Vosborough in New York, and that was pretty special, winning a grade one stake in your life. And but outside, most of them were all special. They were my friends. A lot of them were my friends. The horses were for my friends, and we had one race we win set a track record and one track for John Parrisel, a horse called Simply Majestic. I had my favorite horse of all time, a horse called Proud Run. He had won the Mid-Atlantic point system on the grass, over the Phillies and Mare grass for Liz Hendricks and Ricky Hendricks. And my last one, the big stake win was for Bill Mott on the horse, the stake called the Cotillion. I had wound up picking a horse up, a horse called Fast Cookie, who wound up being a great sire, wound up being a sire of Frosted. But generally, those are mainly that I can remember with some of my favorite horses.
Well, let's talk about the grade one you mentioned. You rode the Jersey Bred Another Reef to victory there in 1985. And had you been riding that horse prior to the grade one Vosburg, or just was that the first time you had the opportunity to ride the horse?
No, I had rode the horse in allowance races for a great trainer called Mr. Jack Ludwig, and he wanted to try him in a graded stake, and everything worked out today. It was a sloppy track. The horse was a mud lover. His pace was fast, and we just come and pick up the pieces at the end. But that was a good day. That was it. And the last one, I was lucky too for Bill Mott. I didn't have a mount in the race, and I was just doing nothing in the jockey's room, and they said, "You want to ride a horse for Bill Mott?" Sure.
Why not?
The favorite got scratched at the gate, and I wound up winning the race. It was the last year before Parks had gotten the slot machines, so that race went up to $1 million. Then it was $250. But that was a good lucky day.
It's a nice
Sometimes
surprise.
It's better to be lucky.
This is true. This is true. What was Fast Cookie like to ride?
She was push button. I had the outside post, and at the time the rail was a very bad place to be at Philadelphia Park at the time, and it was just any time you asked her to go, she just went as easy as she could. You know, if you have more kind of horses like that, I might have won 6,000 races. You know,
Fast Cookie. You mentioned that. You mentioned that the deep rail at Parks, and it's when I rode there anyway, it was still very much that way. But did you have to change your riding style when you would ship into Parks then?
Yeah, you had most of the time, you know, your friends, if you knew friends in the room, you would come in and would say, "Hey Nick, you know, the rail's pretty dead here." And well, I mean, I was riding at the time on the circuit. I just had left New York, and I went there. But you have to ride. You have to ride. You can't go on the rail. It was amazing at that time. You could fit 3-4 horses on the rail, but nobody went on the rail. And sometimes you see shippers, they didn't know, but they would just run up in there, and it was like quicksand. They would run up there and then stop. And here comes the horse, past the middle of the racetrack, just flying. And then I guess when they had changed ownership, they had redone the track, and the rail, it's not as dead now as it has been, but I still see people out in the middle of the track.
That is definitely true. Did you find the same was a bit true at Aqueduct? You see a lot of riders going wide there as well. Is it similar?
No, Aqueduct was probably just the opposite. When you rode an Aqueduct on the inner track or on the outer track, speed was dominant then, and you couldn't go too wide. You'd use your run up all the way around the turn, and the horses on the lead would just get away. You would have to save ground, and plus you had all the people with the that's how the raggers and sheets would started out about that time, and they would take into factor everything how wide you went, and that would be a big handicapping tool for them. They would always want you to save ground.
What do you think of the changes they've just recently made to Aqueduct with doing away with the inner dirt track? What's your opinion on that?
Well, I think because they want to kind of give everybody a little bit more variety. That 7/8 of a mile. They have the mile chute. And I just think that with the inner track, maybe you just limit it to those kind of distances, 7/8, 6.5. So I just think they wanted to see if they can, you know, get more horses shipping in. And they built a new grass course out of that inner course. And I guess they want to try to run maybe a little bit more grass racing, too, at Aqueduct.
Jockey Nick Santagata joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Nick, I want to also talk about your very first graded stakes victory, the Grade 3 Gallarette in 1982. You won aboard a horse by the name of Island Charm. And I would think that would probably stick out to you in your mind as your very first graded stakes victory. And how special was that? And do you remember the race?
Yes, I do. I think it was a Pimlico. It was for a good friend of mine called Steve DeMauro. And I was just so excited that he chose me, you know, at that part of my career to ride a graded stakes for him. And to win the race was such a bonus to win for a trainer like Steve DeMauro. That's what I remember about that. And then eventually I got to be good friends with him, and then his son, Steve DeMauro Jr., wound up training horses later on, and we become great friends and business partners and friends. So it kind of led the way. It kind of opened up a lot of doors after that.
So, Nick, we just talked about the highs of racing, the graded stakes victories and the leading rider titles and all the accomplishments you've had. But we all know there's highs and lows when you're a jockey. And you had a number of spills, pretty bad accidents. And tell us, how many bones have you broken?
Well, I've had numerous concussions, just like an NFL player. I've probably broken 10 ribs, 6 at a time. I've broken my femur bone in half, my wrist. I broke my back. I broke my tibula and tore ligaments. So, you know, that's mostly what, you know, that's part of the game, you know. But thankfully, you know, I mean, you get hurt in the mornings, not at the level as a jockey, but there's still, you know, a risk factor. So, you know, I'm glad I walked away from the sport as far as being a jockey.
I remember reading an article where you were describing they were taking you into the hospital and they all thought you were crazy because you kept talking to yourself about how the race played out and you couldn't figure out what happened. Do you remember that story?
Well, it was at Parks. And what happened was they brought me down. I fell. I was in the ambulance. And they brought us in. That's where they would bring us into the loading dock just to go see the first aid before they sent you to the hospital. And I took off my clothes only because I wanted my valet. You know, I just pulled down my pants to take off my flak jacket because I just paid $200 for it. Because I know when you go to the hospital, they rip off the flak jacket and then you got to buy another one.
Yeah.
And so I give it to the valet, and all through the trip, I'm just going, oh, I think I broke my elbow. Oh, I think I broke my elbow. When I got to the hospital, they thought I was crazy. I'm listening to the guy. He's undressing. They put me in an induced coma for 2 days. It was a Monday. I woke up on a Wednesday. I mean, all I was trying to do was save my flak jacket and tell him where to look at my elbow. But $25,000 worth of tests later, you know, the hospital had to, you know, get their money. And I'm just telling them it was only my elbow. And they didn't do anything for me. Just released me.
Wow. Just wanted to take your flak jacket off, which I understand completely. I remember I had a spill and they cut off my brand new boots. I just bought these nice croup boots and they cut them off. And I was so frustrated. So I get that.
Well, you can understand.
Completely understand that, Nick. And tell us about your wife, Lori, and how you guys met and how she dealt with watching you ride every day and the injuries you went through.
Well, yeah, it's, you know, if you're a jockey, yeah, just like you're, you know, any other athlete, you know, you have a wife. I have my wife, Laura. We met at the track. She's working as a little information booth. And we met and we fell in love. And I've been married 34 years. It's only been married one time, 34 years. We have one beautiful daughter. But every time I would get hurt, you know, she would worry so much. And then, you know, once you get hurt, and it was like she had gotten hurt, you know. And, you know, and it's the ups and that's what the thing that's tough on a jockey's wife is, you know, it's ups and downs, the ups and downs. You know, you're doing so good, then you get hurt. You know, you want to make sure that, you know, your husband's okay, and then you got bills to pay, you know, and then you want to get back, and, you know, and then they're scared they want to happen again. So it's not an easy life. It's not an easy life on a jockey's wife neither.
How do you deal with that as a rider going out to the track, knowing full well in the back of your mind that this you could get hurt at any second, an ambulance follows you around there. So how do you deal with that mentally?
Well, you know, I mean, if you go out to the track, it's just like any other sport. If you go out and you start to play cautious, you start to, you know, to get a little scared here and there, sometimes it's worse than, you know, it's going to happen, you know. Sometimes you just got to go out, you know, you just fly by the seat of your pants and, you know, I mean, it's, you know, it's always in the back of your mind. But, you know, if you have that competitive level, you know, you just keep going on. And you know, it's tough to say. Every jockey, you know, he's individually, he's got his, you know, he has his own opinion about it. But that's the way I always went about it. You know, I probably never thought about it. And sometimes you would say, oh, I got hurt. I just got hurt, so I got that over with, you know. So I'm good for a while, you know. But it's, you know, if it starts to wear on your mind, it's time to quit, you know. That's the way I felt about it.
Nick, let's talk about agents now and what makes a good agent. And did you have several different agents over the years, or did you just have one? Or tell us about that.
I've probably had a lot. I mean, I've rode 32 years. I've only fired two agents. I've had some agents that were pretty good. You know, they were you know, mid-level agents. If I was fortunate enough to get that real top agent, maybe I could have, you know, you could have went to the next level, you know. But, you know, generally the agents I had, they were kind of mid-level agents, you know. But most of the, my biggest asset too was, you know, thank God, you know, I had God to help me out and make me work hard. I was blessed with two things from God. One was hard work, but two was, you know, you have a temper, so that always held me back. But I did most of my hard work got me most of my mounts.
And by hard work, would you just hustle in the mornings, gallop, work a bunch of horses, or?
Yeah, I mean, I would show up every morning. I generally would barely take a day off a week, and I would go off and barn. I would just hit every barn every day, every track. You know, if I was a mommet, I would go to every barn every day. I might go to the farms and, you know, or the wherever the, you know, every opportunity around the area. You know, I mean, that's where I would go. You know, so I mean, that's, you know, I mean, unless you in my day, unless you're Angel Cordero or Jerry Bailey, you know, they came to you. I mean, I had to go to them in order to, you know, to try to get some live mounts.
Well, the hard work paid off. You, as I mentioned, have 4,144 wins. Do you remember that 4,000th victory, that big milestone?
Yeah, believe it or not, it happened one night at the Penn National, and it was nobody was in the stands because they were having construction for the casinos. So, I mean, it was a good number. It was for a good person. It was for one of my good friends called Jason Service. But when I went to Parks the next day, they celebrated over there for me. So they you know, they made me feel good over there.
And what did they do by celebrate?
Well, I had one of my friends. They gave me like a gold watch. So I had the 4,000 win, you know, on it with the insignia. They had a little ceremony. So it made me feel good, though, you know. A big accomplishment, 4,000, you know, especially, I mean, I would, you know, especially all the work I had put into it, you know.
It's a huge accomplishment, Nick. And eventually, though, you decided to retire. And why did you decide to do that at the time?
Well, I mean, I was 52 years old, and the mounts were getting way hard to come by. I mean, I kind of emptied out in New York. I emptied out in Jersey. Even in parks, I emptied out. And I was in Maryland, and I was in Bowie one day, and I said, well, let me go see who I got to see today. And there was nobody. I said, who I got? There's nobody. I don't ride for anybody anymore. And we had a good friend of mine. He was head of New York, Hal Handel. He said, when you're ready to retire, come and see me. I'll see if I can get you a job. And so I, what am I going to do? You know, it was losing. I was losing money. I mean, I was physically able to ride. I just didn't have the business. I was losing money riding than I was not riding. And they gave me a great job in the jockey's room, being a valet. So, I mean, I had insurance. I had insurance. And I got money coming in that, you know, that eventually got to retire sooner or later, you know.
And so that was at what racetrack did you start as a valet?
Aqueduct. Yeah, so what I do now in the morning, you know, I do most like what most, you know, retired, unless some retired jockeys, they go into different levels. I mean, some become agents, some become trainers. I never had the desire to become a trainer. It's a hard job being a trainer. I never became an owner. That's even harder. So I wanted to become a jockey agent, and the opportunity didn't allow me to, so I became a valet, you know, and I gallop horses in the morning until as long as I can. So, you know, and you got to make a living, you know. It's unless you win some Dubai Cups or some Pegasus handicaps, you got to continue working. You know, you live in Long Island. Long Island is pretty, it's a pretty pretty expensive area to live in, you know.
So now you are galloping horses in the morning still to this day, and you're working as a valet in the afternoon then, correct?
Well, my day consists more hard of being a jockey. I get up 4:30 in the morning. I'm at the track galloping by about 5 o'clock, quarter after 5. You know, we start about 5:30. After I gallop, get in my car, I shoot over to Aqueduct, and I saddle horses all day until the end of the card. I help one jockey out, a really good jockey, Eric Hansel, who had just gotten hurt about a week ago. So he had broken two vertebrae. That's my jockey that I help. And he's definitely going to be a good jockey. He's got all the tools. And that's my day now. I enjoy it, you know, but I don't like sitting home. When I do get one day off or something, it's my body, it's unnatural when you get a day off now.
Well, you mentioned the valets help the jockeys, but describe in detail what that actually means and how important it is.
Well, to be a valet, you're working for the track, selling horses, but your other job is to help jockeys. You have to set the tack right, make sure the weight consists of what's in the program. You got to take off the dirt for the next race. You got to put the goggles and the helmet and the silks got to all correspond to the owner's colors. And you just, you know, you're just repetitious until as many mounts as you rise until the end of the day. But you have a lot of responsibility. You got to make sure that weight is right. You got to saddle the horse. You got to make sure the saddle is right on a horse and everything. So there's still a lot of responsibility to be a valet. And the time is, you know, you got 20, 25 minutes of your races. So you got to make sure you got to move quick to get it back for the next race. No dilly-dally.
Well, and without valets, it would be impossible for a jockey to get ready in time, as you mentioned, with such short time in between races. And a valet, how many riders can you help? Do you have more than one? Or?
Well, I mean, it depends upon, I mean, some guys have 3 or 4 riders. Some have 2, you know. Generally, if you have 2 or 3 good riders, that's maximum. You know, because if they ride all the same race, I got to go back and forth, back to back. You know, you gotta move. Being a jockey, I never thought a valet was so hard to do until I became a valet. And in turn, jockeys, they pay the valet 5% of their check. So you're making money that way, and you're making money from saddling your horse. But it's a tough job. You gotta keep up with the pace. But generally you have about 2 good jockeys. 2 good jockeys to, you know, is probably the most you can handle with the time frame you have to go back at.
Do you like still being able to work in the jocks room, still being surrounded by that, what you spent so many years in the jocks room? And do you ever find that you miss riding?
Well, I thank God that, you know, I could work with my friends, you know, who I've known for my whole jockey life, 20, 30, 40 years I've been riding on the track. But that's the good part. But the bad part is, you miss riding. I mean, I talked to Mick Lurie, who does a lot of radio, TV work, and he says to me, how much he misses. It's just, you know, you see, especially during the big, you know, the good weather, the big races and everything, you just want to, after you saddle that horse, you want to get a leg up on the horse and just go out to ride the horse, you know? I miss it a lot, though. I do. I really do.
But I bet you don't miss it as much riding in the cold weather at Aqueduct, especially you mentioned the tough winter we've had this year. What would you do, and how do you help your jockeys deal with the cold weather?
Well, me personally, I didn't mind riding in the winter. Only, you know, when you're winning, that's most like my best at Aqueduct is in the winter. When you're winning, you know, the weather feels warm. But as far as a jockey riding, a lot of jockeys can handle the cold, and a lot of jockeys don't handle the cold. So that's up to them. You know, I mean, I can't, you know, tell them what to do. I mean, I can give them some advice and, you know, wear this, wear that. But, I mean, you know, if you can, you know, once you get used to riding in the cold, you know, eventually you'll get used to it, you know?
Yeah, I think back to riding the last race at Penn National in January.
That's tough. It's the nighttime. You know, when you're riding at nighttime in the winter, that's tough. I mean, at least it was the daytime at Aqueduct, you know?
Yeah, that wasn't fun. That part was not fun. But
you know, I mean, I feel sorry. I mean, the people in the cheaper tracks now, you know, you have to have the jockeys. They become exercise boys. I mean, you go up the Finger Lakes and you see the jockeys there, and I'm sure, I don't know if you had to do it, but they gallop 10 a day. You go to Penn National, they gallop them 10 a day. Out there in Mahoney Park, they're galloping 10 a day to get mounts. But they got to have two jobs in cold, rain. And they got to every day have to get on them horses, or they don't ride the horses. And those are the people I really take my hat off to. They're riding for $8,000, $9,000, $10,000 purses, galloping the horse every day, rain, snow, and shine. They deserve what they get.
Not an easy life.
You know, when you go to the bigger tracks, you know, they have their own exercise boys, you know, and the purses are bigger. You know, it's more high-profile racing. It's a higher level, and people can afford exercise boys and everything. And you know, the jockeys will mostly come out to work horses, but you don't ever see them galloping or jogging the wrong way. You know, it's, you know, the bigger the track, you know, the easier is the mornings anyway, you know.
Let me ask you this. How many horses do you gallop in the morning these days?
Well, I vary anywhere from 5 to 8. And sometimes if somebody comes in drunk, 10, you know. So you have to pick up the slack. And I don't mind it. I mean, the only time it wears you out is in the winter, you know. And when the summer, when you're at Saratoga, that's when you kind of enjoy it. You got the better horses, the weather's better, you know, the purses are better. That's when you mostly enjoy it. That's my second favorite track, Saratoga, except for Monmouth. I'm sure everybody loves Saratoga.
Saratoga's the best, Nick. So now you're kind of established. You're in one spot now, but when you rode, you had to travel so much. We're almost out of time here, but really quickly, I want to address, did you enjoy traveling, or was it just tiresome for you?
Well, I didn't mind. When I was riding in the Meadowlands night and day, I would ride in New York in the day, and I'd ride the Meadowlands at night, and I didn't care, but it was the traveling that would wear you out. That traffic, you know, you're leaving at 5 o'clock, the worst time to leave, and you're always going to hit traffic, and it's always in your mind, am I going to make it there in time? Am I going to make it there in time? But the traffic is one part of racing I don't miss, and spills. I hate to, I don't even look at spills. If I see a jockey has a spill, I just turn away. I can't stand my pain. When I used to fall or I used to get hurt, I would hate pain. And I when I see one of my friends fall, it's just the same. And now I know what they're going through, you know.
Again, it's a tough life, Nick. How long do you think you'll continue galloping horses for?
Man, that's what everybody asks me. I mean, thank God, thank you, man, thank Jesus, I'm fit. I can still do it. But I mean, I'm 60 years old. But I mean, I feel like I can have if I have five more years, that would be pushing the envelope. But you know, you have to get a good. It's for me, or for me to quit galloping horses, I have to get a little better rider in the afternoon to work for, so I can make up for that loss, you know, for the money from galloping horses, you know. But eventually, you know, I'll be able to do it because eventually I can get my house paid up and, you know, your bills start to go down a little bit, you know. But eventually you're going to have to quit riding altogether. The body just can't take it anymore.
Nick, we are all out of time, but thank you so much for joining us. It was great spending the last hour with you and wishing you all the best.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure. Thank you so much, and good luck to you, everybody over there.
So tonight's guest was requested by you, the listeners. Shout out to David McKenna for suggesting Nick Santagata as a guest via Twitter. If you have an idea for a future guest on Jock Talk, send me a message on Twitter at JockeyKMac. Join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Dalapina, I am Christina McManigal, and thank you for listening.